for Monday, March 28th, 2005, and we are going to start with a hearing on House Bill 5044, the Department of Justice Phase 2 presentation. And we will begin with an agency overview. And I'd like to ask Kelly Friels, Budget and Management Division, and the Honorable Hardy Myers, Attorney General, to please come forward.
Actually, Madam Chair, I think I will start off. We actually have a roll in phase two for a couple minutes.
That's exactly right.
Yes.
And before we begin, I do want to apologize to the committee for starting us late this afternoon and tell you that it was absolutely unavoidable. My apologies. And my apologies to the Attorney General as well for the delay in getting us started. Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I've passed out a memo addressed to you from myself. We'll make this real brief because it's much more important, I think, at this stage to hear from the agency and from BAM, but I did want to make sure that a few points were taken. This is what we will be handing out in some shape or form similar to this at the beginning of phase two. I'll let the agency deal with the agency mission. I think you fully understand from phase one and the discussion last week, the priority lists, the primary programs and customers, but I do want to talk a little bit on the second page to make sure you're aware of the budget notes and the e-board actions and audit findings. This agency had two major budget notes, mainly for the General Counsel Division. One was a report to the e-board on the demand for by state agencies for legal services. They had a substantial report that came back and talked about the changes in the use. If you need a copy of that report, we can get it to you. The second report was somewhat similar in nature in terms of the information that it generated, but it talked about the additional exemptions provided to agencies from having the AG's office, the General Counsel Division, review state contracts, which is a major driver in the demand for legal services by state agencies. And I can get you a copy of that report if you so wish. The agency also at the e-board did ask and request permission from the e-board to apply for a number of federal grants. These included a victim's rights compliance project, Internet Crimes Against Children's Task Force, and a sexual assault victim's emergency medical response fund. And I think if you want any more information on those, it's probably best to ask the agency, or I can get you the e-board information from the appropriate meeting that took place by the e-board.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you. Doug, for my information, does the state have a classification for contracting officers? Is that at a professional level?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisner. I'm not sure if there's something called a contract officer, but I do know in agencies there are, in some agencies, rather large contract units that really do nothing but prepare contracts. But in most cases, or for major contracts, the Attorney General's office still has to review.
Is it by dollar amount, or what's it?
Yes, there is. I think it's a $75,000 threshold on personal services contract.
Could that be raised? Would that help workload?
It probably would help workload. I think it's something that would probably be on the schedule for the General Counsel Division when Mr. Don Arnold comes forward. And we can have them highlight that in their discussion if you so wish.
If that was passed 10 years ago and the contracts are higher now, that could be. And if we have especially a professional contracting person that knows how to do contracts. And all we're doing is a legal review.
Right. There were no significant audit findings by the audit division in this case, but I do want to highlight something that the Child Support division may want to talk a little bit about, and on my memo I see I misspelled child. It's CHID in my memo. I apologize for that. Something is wrong with the spell check. And I think they may want to talk about it, but there is a federal audit issue brought by the federal government that they've raised regarding the use of child support federal funds around specific clients. Those are really, for lack of a better term, incarcerated with the Oregon Youth Authority. That I'm sure the agency will highlight when the time comes. In terms of the expenditure history, real briefly, I have a chart there on the second page of the memo. What for those that look at various biennial changes, I think it's important to highlight some significant changes in this agency. I've highlighted three of them that really have general fund implications. If you take a look at the increase between 9901 and 0103 in the general fund, which is the dark bar, part of the bar at the bottom of the bar, part of that was explained by, for the first biennium, I believe that was the first biennium that the legal rate was not subsidizing defense of criminal convictions. It was a change that the legislature took place. Do you want to do that now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think I will waylay here for a minute for something from the subcommittee chair.
Okay. Members and Mr. Attorney General, what I'd like to do with your indulgence is close the hearing briefly on House Bill 5044 to go back to the item at the top of the agenda, the federal grant application, so that we can expedite that. So I close the hearing on House Bill 5044 and open a hearing on the federal grant application. Ms. Lamont.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if Nancy Miller could briefly come forward from the Judicial Department and explain the grant application. The Judicial Department is requesting authorization to submit a statewide drug court enhancement grant application in the amount of $200,000 federal funds. The application submission deadline is March 31st. LFO is recommending approval.
Questions or comments? Representative Wisnot.
Can we use this in family drug court? I still think that that's our biggest, is going to be the most success, is with family drug courts and not just drug.
Madam Chair, for the record, Nancy Miller, Deputy State Court Administrator with the Oregon Judicial Department. Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, the answer is yes. This is not the kind of restricted grant that we've had in the past where we can only do, we've had one juvenile block grant before. We can only do juvenile delinquency. This one is a little bit broader and will allow our statewide coordinator to work with all the different kinds of drug courts. Madam Chair, would you like me to very briefly just say what the grant includes?
Yes, you would, please.
Thank you. It includes funding for a limited duration statewide drug court coordinator. That person would be working with all the different kinds of drug courts that we have around the state, providing technical assistance and training. That person is also the person that does all the national research, figures out the emerging best practices, helps our drug courts understand and implement them, so we don't have drug court coordinators in every county trying to run around and do that work. We're also planning a yearly statewide treatment court symposium. We did our first one this year with some existing funds. Unfortunately, we wouldn't be able to do that every year without the drug court grant, and it was an extremely exciting and dynamic training opportunity. We also have a statewide database, the Oregon Drug Court Management System, ODCMS. We'll be doing some enhancements and upgrades on that. We're also aware, Madam Chair, as our letter indicated, we thought we might get some applications coming in from courts as well. The Multnomah Court is planning to submit an application for their DISP program. Again, an acronym within an acronym. It is very sad that Senator Winters is not here. It's the Dewey Intensive Supervision Program, Driving Under the Influence of Intoxicants Intensive Supervision Program. It's to really adopt the drug court model with drunk drivers. The Multnomah Court is very excited about that and will be submitting an application as well.
Thank you. Senator Devlin, I'll accept a motion to...
I think we need to open a work session.
Close the hearing on the Judicial Department grant application request and open a work session. Senator Devlin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move a put to clarification. I move to recommend approval of the grant application to the full Ways and Means Committee.
Is there any objection?
So ordered. And a carrier for when the full Ways and Means.
Is there a volunteer? Representative Hanson. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank the Attorney General for his indulgence.
Madam Chair, if I could make a suggestion, the next time you need a motion, perhaps a script for the senator would be helpful.
Madam Chair, the only thing I was questioning here is that I was trying to remember the exact process and the difficulties that we have sometimes had in even getting grant applications to subcommittees and to the full committee for approval. So hopefully that process has changed and it's relatively simple now, particularly given something that has the broad merits that this program has.
Thank you, Senator. I'm going to reopen the hearing on House Bill 504 for Department of Justice. And Mr. Wilson, if you'll continue where you left off.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, we were on the second page of the memo for myself and the subcommittee members, looking at that expenditure chart. Real briefly, the second major point I wanted to make was the change between 01-03 to 03-05, and there was a significant increase in general fund. At the same time, there was a decrease in the other funds and an increase in the federal funds. Most of this change was due to the transfer of the administration, or the continuing transfer of the administration, and the transfer of the funding, the general fund portion, to the Department of Justice from the Department of Human Services. So those sort of three main changes in the three major revenue sources are due to that transfer. And finally, on the top of the next page, if you take a look at the difference between 0305, 0507, again, another significant increase in general fund, and that's chiefly due to the use of general fund offsetting the what had been funded with criminal fines and assessments. So you see a large increase in general fund there. On the next page, there's a chart that may look familiar out of our write-up on revenue sources. I won't go through that unless there's specific questions, but then move on to the major policy and budget issues. These may be repeated by Mr. Friels, but I'll make this quick. A few things to keep in mind. The subcommittee will review the legal rate charged to state agencies. We may yet do it this week, as I have discussions with the co-chair and a subcommittee chair. I think the department will talk about some cash flow issues with specific programs, primarily the Consumer Protection and Financial Fraud Program. We've briefly touched on that in this subcommittee in previous hearings. There are backlogs that continue for the Trial and Appeals Division in terms of defense of criminal convictions. The governor's budget continues to cut by roughly 10% of this program, which probably means the backlogs will likely to continue. Most of the programs in this budget that were general funded, including those that had funding transferred from criminal fines and assessment to general fund, were reduced by roughly 10%. The exception to that was the Child Support Enforcement Program, and the reason for that are some pretty significant federal penalties that could occur if they don't meet federal standards. The most significant policy package, and I'm sure they will spend quite a bit of time when you get to the general counsel position, are 19 new positions that are the result of another policy package in the Department of Human Services budget for Children and Families, or CAF. These new positions in Department of Justice would assist the child welfare staff in the Human Services Department and preparing court documents representing the state and the court on the behalf of the state. Keep in mind the decision here generally starts in the Department of Human Services budget. They are the ones with the general fund. It's really a reaction to the up or down vote or approval of that package in Human Services that will mean whether it's funded in this budget as other funds. It is a payment from Department of Human Services to the Department of Justice. And finally, just a note, there are ongoing discussions of potential workload on ballot measure 37 that may occur. There is nothing in the budget for ballot measure 37 at present specifically outlined in DOJ's budget for that. And Madam Chair, that completes a quick sort of overview. Our part will take we'll have a lot more information from LFO during the work session, or I guess it's phase three. But I do want to remind the committee members of sort of what phase two is about. Phase two is more specific budget information. It also follows up with questions and responses to questions or issues you raised during phase one. I need you to please remember that if you have questions, you need more work done, please bring them up. That includes changes you may want to make or suggest to performance measures, because my understanding is the subcommittee will be voting on performance measures during the work session. So if you see a need for a change or want to propose a new performance measure, for example, I think phase two, when you go through performance measures later today, would be a good time to raise that so staff and the agencies can work on getting responses or getting changes made and getting ready for work session. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm ready to move on.
Are there questions for our analyst, Mr. Wilson? Senator Devlin?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, at what stage will we get into the discussion about the governor's use of criminal fines and assessments in terms of running them through the general fund and then running them back to programs?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I think the plan from the co-chairs right now, because they're still thinking about that, to the analyst point, at this point, if we don't work session this budget, it doesn't matter if it's general fund or CFA until work session. So I think my advice would be continue talking about it. If you have input of using CFAA, I think the discussion should be directed to the co-chairs. But it's relatively easy for staff during work session to change from general fund to CFAA when the decision is made. If the decision is made is probably the better term.
Madam Chair, I have a fairly complex question for Mr. Wilson. Would you like me to put it in writing to Mr. Wilson, or you would like me to say it orally now and then try to put it in writing?
Why don't we do both?
Okay. The question is, if you took the current CFAA funds, took the currently the percentage that in the former budget was going to be the Board of Police Standard Safety and Training, and then the percentages going to all the other programs where criminal fines and assessments go, what reductions would be necessary in those programs that are other than BPSST, just that were based upon criminal fines and assessments?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I probably will have to do a little figuring to get to that point, but just as a reference point, as the governor was putting his budget together, they were contemplating if the sharing stayed the same, the splits, and the growth in DP or in Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, you would have seen, I think, 28% to 30% cuts across the programs to meet that change.
But in the sense if the Department of Police Standards, Safety and Training didn't cost so much more, and you had the same distribution that you had in 03-05. I'm trying to find out if we would have actually had the same level of potential cuts in, like, domestic violence programs and other victims' assistance programs that we're now currently contemplating.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I'll have to verify that, but my guess would be without the growth in DPSST, and apologize for the pig, it would be, there wouldn't have been significant cuts to the other programs.
If you could verify
yes.
that, Mr. Wilson.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair. If, in the same line, could you, and I have forgotten now whether the debt service for the COPs for building the new facility are being paid for with criminal fines and assessments, or whether that's a separate issue, and whether that proportionality that Senator Devlin is asking, if that would change if we were funding the debt service for BPST with general fund.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, actually right now in the governor's budget there is no separate CFA or criminal fines and assessment funding. Everything is general fund. All of the CFA revenues go into the general fund. But I think if what you may be asking is if you kept the same percentage again and pulled out the debt service, mm-hmm. which in the governor's budget is roughly, I believe, $10 million, what would the impact be to the remainder of the programs within DPSSD and all the other programs?
I guess I'm asking the same thing that Senator Devlin has, only with splitting it both in their operating funds and the debt service.
Madam Chair, it sounds like I need to put a table together to that addresses all these together, which I actually have in part done for the co-chairs.
Continuing on then, Mr. Friels from Budget and Management Division.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The record, Kelly Friels with Budget and Management Division. I'm going to go through the presentation document you have before you. Doug has a copy. And I'm going to start on page 2. And my plan is to briefly highlight the governor's recommended budget at a very high level to give you context for the more detailed presentation that the Attorney General and his staff will be providing. And since this is the start of phase 2, we have coordinated this presentation with the Legislative Fiscal Office, but you may find that there is other information that would be more useful or displayed differently. I'd be happy to get those comments or suggestions so we can make changes to this presentation so it fits better with what your needs are. So with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me start on page 2. And the first two slides are just to give you context. Again, from a total funds perspective, this department is requesting $284.3 million. I made a comparison just to the public safety program area, and that would be about a 12%. This agency makes about 12% of this program area. I know that you also include the judicial department, so if you the judicial branch. So if you include the judicial branch, this budget makes up a little less than 10% of those two program areas together. Again, talking total funds. And then if you go to the next page, slide 3, I make the same comparison for just general fund and lottery funds. We again give you comparison. Looking at just public safety, the judicial the Justice Department makes up about $47 million, which is a little around 3%. If you again include the judicial branch in this, it amounts to about 2.3% of the total budget. So again, you're talking about, in general fund and lottery fund perspective, a very small piece of the overall general fund lottery fund pie. Moving to slide 4, again, the governor wanted us to make sure you're aware that he did craft his budget based on the 6 principles that have been discussed several times, and I highlighted 4 of the 6 principles that make up the vast majority of this budget. You might recall that the governor, when he did prioritize first finance those obligations required under the Oregon Constitution, federal law, or required by courts, or also debt service, and then he used the 6 principles to finance his other investments that make up this budget. Moving to slide 5, talking about the funding sources that make up the governor's recommended budget for DOJ. starting at the top, it's dominated by other funds, $138 million. 48% of this budget is other funds, and as you well know, the vast majority, about $100 million of this, is from legal billings to state agencies. Another $27-28 million is from child support collections. These are collections from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family program that is used to finance the child support program. If you move clockwise, you can see federal funds there that makes up 28%, and then there's the limited and the non-limited. I might just point out the limited, both federal funds and other funds, are those expenditures where you put a maximum spending cap on them. There's also another category of non-limited, which I believe you're looking at more closely this time, where there's some other limiting factor, such as a contract or an agreement, or these are pass-through dollars, such that you only pass through the amount of money you get. So if you look at the federal funds, the vast majority of those federal funds are for support of the child support program. And remember, for every $3 that are spent on the child support program, $2 are reimbursed by the federal government. Moving to the other funds, non-limited, that's primarily child support and crime victims assistance dollars, and then general fund, probably the largest categories are the state match for child support, the defense of criminal convictions, and the crime victims dollars that were financed formerly with CFAA or criminal fines and assessments and are now in the governor's budget, included under the general fund. Slide 6 is the same information you received from the department and in the first presentation. Again, child support making up the largest of the seven divisions that make up the department. Moving to slide 7, the governor's budget included personal services of 58% of the total spending in this department. It's interesting. I assume that attorneys would be the predominant classification that makes up this department. It turns out that's their secondary. There's actually 300 or over 300 child support case managers that make up this budget, and there's only 210 attorneys. So this is an agency that's heavily financed with state employees. You'll find in other agencies, such as Department of Corrections, it's the same way. But if you move to the human resource budget or the K-12 budget, you'll find that most of the expenditures go out as special payments. Within services and supplies, those business-related costs, the two dominant expenditure items in this area are legal services at $20 million and facilities costs at $11 million. Within the capital outlay category, or those expenses that are over $5,000, pretty much half of this is for office furniture associated with the renovation that's taking place, and the other half is related to data processing costs that the agency anticipates having. And again, special payments predominantly are made up of crime victim assistance and child support payments to district attorneys. Moving to slide 8, I think Doug pretty much covered the same information I wanted to as far as general fund. He provided the history, as you can see there. I just wanted to note, if you look at the increase between the 2003-05 biennium and the 2005-07 budget that's recommended by the governor, that's about a $15.5 million increase. And 14.1 of that is because of the fund shift that took place, eliminating criminal fines and assessments out of this budget and financing that within general funds. So if we didn't have that adjustment, this general fund budget would have only increased by about 4%.
Madam
Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin.
I thought it should also be noted that it looks like the vast majority of the increase from 03 to 0305 was the transition of the child all the child support, the various functions of it to the Department of Justice.
Point well made. Madam Chair, I'm on slide 9, major policy issues. Again, as Mr. Wilson noted, the governor did make 10% reductions for all the general fund programs and those that he converted from criminal fines and assessment, with the exception of the child support program. And as Mr. Wilson pointed out, he mentioned one of the reasons because of the federal penalties that we were concerned about. Also, revenue from this program also finances programs in human services. Our child welfare program, as well as the Oregon Youth Authority, receives dollars, and this cut would have adversely impacted those or affected those programs. As a result of that, the governor chose to take all the other 10% reductions, but not the child support reduction. We talked several times about the criminal fines and assessment fund shift, so I won't discuss that. In the governor's budget, we did the bottom bullet, reduce staffing in the tobacco tax compliance task force. If you recall, in 2001, this task force was implemented to be more aggressive in collecting tobacco tax. And the 2003 legislature expanded that with anticipation of substantial amount of additional resources during the governor's process. As a result of those resources not coming in at the level we had originally anticipated, reduced that the funding or the positions down to the funding level that the 2001 legislature approved. And finally, Madam Chair, moving to slide 10, the governor's budget for this agency does include 14 policy packages. And just to give you context, the agency, when they presented their budget to the governor, had 26 policy packages that totaled $5.5 million of general fund. And every one of those policy packages had was important for consideration by the governor, but because of the limitation in resources, he was unable to finance the packages. So his direction was to finance those that had limited general fund effect, that didn't affect the rate charged agency for legal billing, and also had a good fiscal or policy reason. So the 14 packages that are included in the governor's budget are within that specific criteria. The Justice Building renovation is something we have to do. The department has a number of packages that identify better ways of doing workload, or they have other funding sources in order to finance their workload. There are a number of changes in the child support program to continue to get federal grant money, or new ideas of how we might be able to fully match child support and in the Multnomah County courts that the department will discuss with you. Also within the child support program, there are federal matching dollars that go out to the 28 district attorneys for the child support services, and the department wants to discuss with you the opportunity of moving those dollars, those pass-through dollars, from a limited capacity to non-limited. And finally, as Doug points out, there are two additional requests, the largest being the Department of Human Services, 19 positions. Madam Chair, the last slide, slide 11, as Doug already pointed out, there is an expectation that the hourly rate charged agencies will be reduced. The governor's budget did not adjust the rate. The Attorney General, in building his agency request budget, requested that the Attorney General billing be at $119 an hour. And even though we made some reductions to the budget, we did not adjust the rate accordingly. So we anticipate that that will be a process that you folks will be discussing. And finally, there will be some technical adjustments that Mr. Wilson and myself, the department, will bring forward at a later time. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions or comments for Mr. Friels? Senator Devlin.
There's probably an easy explanation for this. It's probably just, what are the analyst adjustments?
The technical adjustments?
Yes.
Technical adjustments are, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, typically errors that we made during drafting of the government. Thank you for raising that.
Okay.
Typically, the technical adjustments are those that don't have any policy implications, but we found as we go back through and look at the work that we did, that there are small adjustments we need to make between personal services and services and supplies, or we miss something, and we bring those forward.
I'm glad you found them.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, we'll probably continue to find more as we go through this. Thank you.
Senator Devlin, perhaps we need another pig for euphemisms. Okay, I think, Mr. Attorney General, would you like to take us through the presentation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, Connie Myers, Attorney General, and pleased to open your phase two consideration of the department's budget. First, a quick revisit to our mission, which we've reviewed with you earlier, and I would simply at this point note again that in the concluding portion of it, the department's mission, as we presently stated, is to advance and uphold the rule of law in Oregon as that applies to the government itself, to individual citizens, and to the economy, to commerce. And I might say, too, that that effort, in terms of upholding the rule of law, includes an effort to contribute to holding lawbreakers to a just accountability, both in the criminal side of our activity and on the civil side, and to work to help to meet the needs of victims of lawbreaking, both criminal and civil, and to try to help heal and restore and heal them. Core services are centered in different parts of the department, the Office of the Attorney General, which is the administrative oversight part of the department, my immediate staff, office and immediate staff, and then our appellate division, the child support program, civil enforcement division, criminal justice division, the general counsel, trial divisions, and our administration or administrative services division, and we'll be, of course, re-examining these in more detail as we go along. The next slide gives you a bird's eye view again of the department's overall budget, recommended budget, and expenditures by program and in FTE. At this point, I would just note again that the two priority areas the subcommittee has identified, and these agree with our recommendations, legal services to state government and services to children and families, account for about 76% of expenditures of the total department, and about 80, almost 90% actually of our personnel, of our FTE, in those two particular areas. The recap here of the government's recommended budget, I won't dwell on very long, but just to note again that the general fund change, the $11.8 million, as has been already noted, explained by Mr. Wilson and also commented on by Mr. Friels, that $11.8 million represents basically the shift of the CF criminal fines and assessment, previously other funds allocation to general funds, less the reductions in the CFAA allocation and the reductions in the other general fund program areas of the department that are called for reductions, defense of criminal convictions, Medicaid fraud, district attorney assistance, organized crime, and the domestic violence and sexual assault victims grant program. Budget history reviewed for you from 1995-97 to 2005-2007. Steady and sometimes fairly sharp growth in the general funds area, but has already been mentioned the changes from 99 to 2001, from 2001 to 2003 through 03 to 05 are reflect certain changes that were detailed by legislative by Mr. Wilson, including both the augmented funding of the Defense of Criminal Convictions and the ending of the so-called subsidy through the legal rate, and then of course the transfer of the budget for the child support program from the Department of Human Services this biennium to the Department of Justice. Next slide shows you a bar graph of the department's all funds and FTE growth, 95-97, to the pending governor's recommended budget. Again, the shift of the Division of Child Support Program Director's Office and the budget for the program is highlighted for you in the change in the 0103 and 0305 approved budgets. Quick recap again of the budget reductions that have already been noted. 10% in the Defense of Criminal Convictions, 10% in DA Assist Organized Crime, a reduction in the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force, which would take it back essentially to its starting funding level of the 2001 session, 10% reduction in the Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund, 10% in the Medicaid Fraud Unit, which has a 3-to-1 federal match that's implicated by that general fund reduction, and then the CFAA, Criminal Fines and Assessment, 10% reduction from the 03-05 allocation coupled with a shift. So that's a hard 10% reduction. Shift to the general fund, which implicates the flow of revenue to the victim's compensation program, to the victim assistance programs that are operated in each district attorney offices and that receive a distribution of criminal fines and assessment funds through the Department of Justice based on the amount that is contributed into the criminal fines and assessment account from that particular county, from the convictions in that particular county. And then also that 10% reduction ripples through to the child abuse multidisciplinary intervention program, including the medical examinations and the assessment centers.
Mr. Attorney General, I believe we have a question from Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Attorney General Myers, how would you manage those 10% cuts? For example, defense of criminal convictions.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, if it would be agreeable to the subcommittee, we're going to talk about management of reductions when we come to the particular program areas in some detail, if that would be agreeable to you.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Attorney General, I'm having a little trouble again trying to look at numbers. The 14 policy packages, so there's $5.4 million from Department of Justice for policy packages. But that was only half, or the governor didn't approve. It was DAS's presentation. So, when we're looking at the essential packages and the policy packages, that's outside the governor's budget. The $7.2 million, because I think it's in the governor's budget.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I'm not looking at the specific chart that you are. I can't know that. The essential packages are the same from the agency request to the governor's recommended, so there shouldn't be any changes there. The agency request included a little over about $5.4 million of policy packages. The governor only included, I think, around $130,000 of general fund. So that would be the discrepancy or the difference between the agency request and the governor's recommended, if that's answering your question.
What's the page that, Madam Chair?
Please continue.
It's the page that the Attorney General's on now. We just went through. So there's that totals 284. And that's got a policy package and an essential package.
This is it. Right? Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do I have the right? Back. Oh, okay.
So that doesn't include any of the 10% reduction.
The $284.3 million total funds does include the 10% reductions.
Which are gone.
Correct. In the governor's recommended budget, they are gone. Representative Wisnant, Madam Chair.
Then one final, Madam Chair, so then what I was trying to figure out is to refund this 10%, we're looking at, what, $3 million more? Or is that the 5.4?
That's...
About 5.4.
Madam Chair, Representative Bisnett, it would be a little over $5 million. That's about 5.1.
Thank you.
And then, Madam Chair, while we have it under budget reductions, very significantly, there is no general fund restoration in the governor's recommended budget for the support of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Program. Turning to budget drivers for the Department of Justice, we're very much affected, of course, by personal services costs, a significant part of our budget, as was noted earlier. The level of demand for legal services and other services rendered by the department, other fund balances, I mean, on that further in just a moment, the effect of policy packages ultimately acted on by the legislature, as well as new legislation. Personal services costs, of course, composed primarily of issues of salary costs, PERS retirement costs, PERS bond assessments, agencies, and then, of course, the effect of collective bargaining agreements. Turning first to the driver of demand for legal services, bottom line, you can see that from 01 to 03 to 03-05 projected, the aggregate demand for legal services for the department was almost level, just a slight 0.25% decrease, resulting from a mix of increases and decreases in different areas of legal services provision. One projection we made at the beginning of the 03-05 biennium, the last budget-making process, was that we anticipated that the continuing budget turmoil would continue to generate litigation for the state resulting from budget adjustments, and we think that this 3.81% figure increase in trial represents primarily those kinds of increased litigation, increased litigation activity flowing off of dissatisfaction with and claims of violations of law resulting from budget changes. The other fund balances as a budget driver, the department is dominantly, as has already been noted, an other funds agency. And so in our different other funds program areas, it's very important that we give attention to the balances we try to maintain in those program accounts from end of one biennium, start of the next, and then to the end of the next. Different factors we consider or considerations about the appropriate level of balance. Is the program 100% other funds, or is it a mix of funds? Is the revenue predictable, variable, volatile? Does it come monthly, quarterly, at other intervals? Is there sufficient working capital to meet the program operating requirements? And then, which follows, is a quick recap of where we project we're going to be with respect to the different other funds, at least partially or entirely other funds areas, or federal funds and other funds areas. Medicaid fraud, we project what we think will be an adequate ending balance for 05-07. Our legal fund is derived from the billings to agencies through time. Both the Department of Administrative Services and the Legislative Fiscal Office have encouraged and supported the department in trying to maintain about 2 months' working capital in the Legal Services Fund, and that's about exactly what these numbers represent. Child support, similarly, we think will be have an adequate balance. The criminal injuries compensation account is probably the most volatile account in the Department of Justice. primarily because of the variance in the flow of punitive damages into that account as prescribed by law. Fortunately, we're going to receive a fairly substantial settlement just within the next few weeks that's going to take the ending balance for this biennium up and set us on course for a stable, a good ending balance in 2005-07. And finally, charities and gaming, two areas where we're feeling the ending balance for 2005-07 is going to be more questionable, more marginal still. We'll view it as adequate, but we think there could be program changes, fee changes probably needed in the 2007-09 biennium. Then finally, our consumer protection education program, projecting a very, very small 2005-07 ending balance, unless program support or expenditure changes are made. We'll be talking further about that situation when we get to that program area. Policy packages, as mentioned, there are 16 approved in the governor's recommended budget. Those represent 18.19 FTE. Most of those FTE are in that Department of Human Services, Department of Justice, Child Welfare package that Mr. Wilson noted. There are FTE or portions of FTE approved in certain other locations of the department, trial, appellate, criminal justice, that will also be noted in more detail. Final budget driver, I note, is new legislation, both initiated legislation by the people as well as enacted by the Legislative Assembly, litigation arising from reductions in state budgets. Already noted that as a driver of legal activity. Measure 37, a new driver of legal services work in the department. Methamphetamine, the movement of the state to try to construct a coordinated response to the methamphetamine issue may or may not wind up with recommendations and actions that add to Department of Justice authorized positions and responsibilities. Simply don't know yet. Public contracting. Major changes in the public contracting laws became effective March 1 of this biennium. Will be a while yet, I think, knowing how those changes will sort out in terms of adding to for a while, perhaps, and then perhaps ultimately reducing public contracting legal services needs. Use of deadly force, as Madam Chair, of course, well knows, and as the report I've distributed to the other members indicates, part of the use of deadly force report I've submitted to the Assembly calls for some amount of state resource commitment to the costs of planning and administering policies dealing with deadly force, primarily at the local level. What the Assembly's ultimate decisions about those will be, and where the administration of such a program would be vested if it's created, all legislative decisions, the report recommends Department of Justice for that administrative responsibility. And then there may be other legislation as the session goes along that will have a net effect one way or the other on the total workload service demands of the Department of Justice. Madam Chair, that concludes my initial overview as a segue to the more, I think, first our performance measures discussion and then our more detailed view of the different program areas.
Are you able to share at this point what we might be looking at around litigation arising from reductions in state budgets? Some of that information obviously will come after decisions are made, but what?
Well, Madam Chair, I think the first and most important thing we can do is to try to work as closely with the legislature, and this would be, I presume, in combination with Legislative Counsel's office, to make sure we have identified for the Assembly significant legal risks that might be entailed in one or another budget choice, particularly as it might affect federal law or or create issues under federal law or under the Oregon Constitution. I think that's the first and most important threshold thing we can do. Try to make sure that you have an informed basis for judging the risk you may be running in regard to a particular budget step.
Is that happening?
Madam Chair, I don't know if at this point there has been specific counsel along that line up to this phase, which has been more introductory, but certainly it would be our intention, Madam Chair, before final budget decisions are made at any of the subcommittees, if we believe that a particular indicated course of action is going to expose the state to significant risk, we will definitely make that known to the particular subcommittee and the co-chairs.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A different line, if that's okay. So on the Medicaid fraud, that's a 3-to-1 match. I assume that's 25 state, 75 federal. Some of those cases would come to maybe consent agreements, but some of them should come to settlements and payments if there has been fraud. How are the payments divided up between the state and federal government?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I'm not sure I can give you a generalized answer to that. If I could, we'll be prepared when we come to the Medicaid Fraud Unit to give you examples of how that has worked in particular cases. I'm not sure there's a general answer that applies.
That'd be helpful. Thank you. The
feds do get their share of the money.
Bonus.
Other comments or questions for the Attorney General? Well, then I believe that we're ready to move to the next category, the performance measures discussion. Thank you very much for your time with us this afternoon. And I'm going to ask Brunel Schenkel to come forward.
Madam Chair, just as a reminder to the subcommittee, if you see changes that you want to make in performance measures, please move so we can work on them after and get ready for a work session.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Gardley and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ronelle Schenkel, Policy Project and Legislative Coordinator for the Attorney General. Here today because one of my projects, which is really more of an ongoing assignment than a project, is to coordinate our department's performance measures and our internal committee. So I'm here today to give you that overview, hopefully a brief one, and talk about some possible areas of improvement. We do have an interagency committee. It consists of persons from our front office, our executive team, as well as several of our division administrators and some technical staff. And we are striving to focus by using performance measures both to maintain quality services that we currently provide, but also to look at those areas and use it as a tool for areas of potential improvement for our department services. As you will see by the quick overview of our measures, we have 13 measures, and as you are aware from phase one of our budget presentation and our general overview, we have quite a diversity of programs and therefore customers that we serve. As a brief reminder, we have four goals that our performance measures fit into. One is that of providing efficient, high-quality services to our customers. Quality legal services, of course, are primarily given to other state agencies. But we also have a goal related to client satisfaction, which not only covers our state agencies that we partner with, but many of the citizens in various areas of need within the state. A third goal is to enhance public safety. We identify, investigate, and prosecute criminal actions in conjunction with other partners, and we support crime victims. And our fourth goal is to improve the effectiveness and increase support to children and families through our child support program. As you can see by the slides, the first slide was full of seven measures that tend to be more general and cross the boundaries of the department, and the second slide tends to get to some of our more specialized measures and programs. We aren't going to go over those unless you want a review, since they were presented in our first hearings, but we were going to move on to sort of breaking them into areas that we think we have good, accurate goals and targets and measures, and then talk about some that perhaps need some assistance from you. First of all, you can see some of our performance measures listed on the next screen that we think are currently written in a way that they're effective, efficient tools for us and for you to use in communicating with the citizens, and also that the target areas are reasonable. We may be meeting them, we're more likely striving to meet them, but they're in the ballpark of achievable outcomes. And those are listed for you on this current slide. Our first measure of legal cases in which the state's position is upheld, our civil recoveries, our legal billing receivables, collecting those monies from agencies using our services, our criminal justice cases which are resolved, our crime victims' compensation claims that are paid out to the citizens, child support being distributed, child support being collected versus what may be owed by the citizens, child support arrears, which is another significant part of the program, and then having orders in place so that we can collect and distribute those child support. Those are all measures where we feel that we have, again, strong language that is workable, easily communicated, and that the targets are on track. But then with Chair Gordley's indulgence, we might point out a few areas that we request that you take a look at doing some changes with us. 130 performance measure 137-2 is one that we have struggled with quite a bit in our internal committee. And the reason for that is if you look at the current text of the measure, it talks about the percentage of litigation resolved through settlement. As I understand the history of this measure, it originally came at a time when the legislature was paying a good deal of attention to mediation and negotiation, all parts of the legal world that the Department of Justice functions in. But as you start to delve into the services that we provide, we find that this text is a little too broad. There are some areas of litigation that the Department of Justice is involved in that are simply not appropriate for settlements. It is not likely that you are going to negotiate, for example, on a termination of parental rights. You have a child abuse situation and parents' rights being removed, and it is not likely that spending time on mediation is going to change the outcome of that type of scenario once you're into litigation. Certainly there are things that happen beforehand, but at the point of litigation, it's not likely. Another example would be the area of post-conviction relief cases, persons that are already convicted and incarcerated. And yet our performance measure requires us to look at those and calculate those in now. The other thing that I'll point out to you that we've struggled with is initially when agencies such as ours were going through coming up with targets without any baseline data, our measure was set at 70%. Quite honestly, part of that is due to incorrect calculations, and that target is not something that we believe we can get anywhere close to, especially if we're measuring all of the types of cases that we litigate in the department. Our proposal or our suggestion to you is in the box below. We propose that we modify the text of the measure to insert the word appropriate. Absolutely, we should be measuring those cases that the department is litigating where it's appropriate to be mediating and negotiating and trying to reach settlement rather than going through litigation costs. But that would not be all types of cases, as previously mentioned. The other thing that we believe, based on the data that you have in our annual report and in the budget documents before you, you'll see that we're at a rate of 32% currently. We believe that we need to reduce this target to a more achievable goal. There is the possibility of keeping a high target, but then basically what you would be instructing us to do is to continue to settle a case at all costs, even when that's not in the best interest of the state to do so. Keeping in mind the services that we provide and the clients that we represent being very diverse, there are times when that is not the best outcome for the state overall. So we would recommend a reduced target. Because of the apples and oranges, so to speak, of this particular measure in our documentation in the past, trying to measure all cases, we don't currently have a recommendation for you, but would be happy to report back on what an achievable target might be somewhere closer to the 30% range, and then get some good data based on looking at just those cases that are appropriate for settlement and resolution. So that was our first area that we wanted to highlight for you that we believe needs some work and some assistance with your guidance.
Comments or questions on that particular modification?
Okay. The next one we want to talk about is performance measure 137-4, which is the average time from receipt of a contracting document into our department to the first substantive response back to the agency so they know we are reviewing it and have taken some initial steps. As you can see, our measure target is 13 days, and our performance has been averaging at 5 days. We feel that through a variety of activities, some of which were stimulated by the actions of this committee last session, that we have taken significant steps to improve in this area. We are recommending that we reduce this. We don't need an overall average of 13 days on all contracts. We're proposing 9 days to give us some leeway. Some contracts are larger and more complex than others, of course, and so there is a variance in an overall average, but we are proposing a reduction in that target.
So the selection of 9 days is based on?
9 days, as I understand it, Chair Gordley, was based on a review of those contracts that still, given previous legislative changes, will be coming through our department on a regular basis and will need administrative and legal oversight, but still having a variety of types of contracts and size and length that gives us some leeway to still take the appropriate time to review those more complex contracts.
The performance, the current performance of 5 days, does it take into account those variations that you're talking about?
I don't know. I have Mr. Lampka here with me that reviews the numbers, and if we don't have that background information, Don Arnold from General Counsel will be able to provide that when he does his presentation. I don't know that we have that backup with us today, Chair Gordley.
For the record, my name is Jim Lampka. I'm the Fiscal Services Manager for the Department of Justice. The 5 days does represent the actual results that we had through fiscal year ended June 30th. So it would take into account the contracts that had been reviewed to that point. The reason, as I understand it from our general counsel division, that they wanted to move to a 9-day target instead of a 5-day is that there are some potential changes in how contracting will be conducted in Oregon, and they wanted to allow for that possibility of having an impact on how quickly they can respond to those contract questions.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. Representative Wisnett.
Madam Chair, thank you. I went through real fast, and all the measures look good, but this is one area where on contracting, you're just measuring, you know, getting the product out. You're not measuring how good your contract is. You might want to consider a performance measure that, you know, all the 99% of the contracts are upheld or you know, not 99% or less than 1% are ever contested or something like that. Because, you know, you're not looking how good the contract is. You're looking how fast you get your work out. So.
Chair Gordley and Representative Wisnett, thank you for that comment. Again, when Don Arnold comes, he can give you some background on why they measured the timeliness as the performance rather than perhaps the enforceability and the legality of it and provide you with some additional information. Moving on. 137-6 is our performance measure related to charities reports coming in. More in keeping with Representative Wisnett's comment here, you'll notice that this is a combination measure. It measures both the timeliness and completeness of reports coming in from organizations to our department. As you can imagine, the agencies that are involved in charitable activities come in a variety of sizes and types, and they each do, as I understand it, an annual report to our department. Part of what we are proposing here, our measure target is 79%, and our performance is at 67%. We're proposing a reduction on our target to 70%, and the reason for that is we believe it's important to strike a balance between having those timely reports so we know what's occurring out in Oregon, but also not losing the accuracy. We certainly could continue working towards 79% and forcing those charities to turn them in more timely, But our understanding is at times the delay is caused by the fact that they perhaps are having a CPA review their records or are accumulating the details, which gives us the accuracy in the reports. And we don't believe that that's a piece that you or we would want to lose, is the accuracy of the information sent in, just at the cost of having them timely. We think if we adjust down to 70%, that will allow us the flexibility for those that still need additional details and accuracy to come in slightly slower, but overall to keep them moving in a timely manner. The next measure that we ask that you look at is 137-7. It's our percentage of state agencies responding that rank the quality of our legal services provided as good to excellent, in the good to excellent range. As you can see, our measure target has been at 84%. Our performance came in at 97. We are very pleased with our annual survey, and this is a survey that our department began doing actually ahead of the curve on customer service surveys. Our general counsel has been doing outreach to state agencies that we provide legal services to, and our annual report reported to you 84% based on our last review. We recently completed our annual review for this go-round, and that came in at 97%, so we clearly had made some significant strides that pleased the agencies. You'll note in our box that we don't necessarily think we'll maintain completely at 97%, because just given the nature of our business and giving legal services to agencies, sometimes it's good news and sometimes it's bad. And we would propose that a 95%, while still a pretty aggressive target for our customer satisfaction, is something that we would be able to strive to achieve on an ongoing basis.
I would think that there's a difference between good and excellent. Why not break the response down to those two categories, good and excellent, to see what that would tell you. For example, can you tell us now, in the current performance, what percentage of state agencies rank the quality as excellent versus good?
Chair Gordley, I don't have the actual report statistics in front of me. Donna will be able to bring those with him from General Counsel, but I will share this with you. We, as I mentioned, had started this annual survey prior to the statewide customer service project. This report that we just did, we went to the standard, so to speak, four-point scale that they're asking all state agencies to use. So we're in the process of converting our data to that new standardized scale, and I do believe with the four-point scale, you'll have, and I don't remember, I apologize, which way they went, if one was good or four was good, but you'll have two numbers, and I presume, therefore, behind this, the breakdown of where we fell in those two areas.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think on all of these types of surveys, I would like to see the number of people responding or the percentage of responses.
Chair Gordley, Representative Hanson, we do have the numbers of agencies that went to versus agencies that responded, and we will bring that to you as well. Okay. Then we also would like to propose to the committee for consideration the addition of some performance measures in the areas of domestic violence and sexual assault. And if I might, we would like to ask Connie Gallagher from our Crime Victims Assistance section to come up and give you some information about the recommendations in that area.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair. Subcommittee members, I'm Connie Gallagher. I'm the Director of Crime Victims Assistance at the Department of Justice. In part due to the discussion that we had during the Phase 1 presentation, we gave thought to whether we couldn't develop a meaningful domestic violence performance measure. So what we would like to propose for your consideration today is the following. 90% of adult victims leaving domestic violence shelters will leave with a safety plan. And I would like to mention that in addition to this performance measure, we certainly do the types of performance measures, client satisfaction, client feedback type surveys that you've just been hearing about. In addition to this, we also have a work group that is looking at more comprehensive performance measures. But at the moment, we'd appreciate any comments that you have about this proposed performance measure.
What is the current reality as people are leaving a shelter? I guess my first thought is, why wouldn't you want the target to be 100%?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we certainly do want it to be 100%. We have just been starting to gather some data on the number of adult victims who spend at least one night in shelter and who receive assistance in developing a plan that is obviously going to provide at least a minimal level of safety and hopefully long-term safety in the event that they do find themselves in an abusive or potentially abusive situation. What we have found is that the average is about 88% of the adult victims leaving shelter leave with a safety plan. But what is interesting is that it varies significantly based on the part of the state and based on the age of the victim, primarily because of the length of stay that the person that the person stays in the shelter. So in other words, if an adult victim is in the shelter for only one night, and if a shelter tends to have adult victims, a larger percent of their population that is only there for one or two nights, they have a much lower average than the 88%. And yet in other parts of the state, they find that the women tend to stay longer in the shelters, and their average is higher than the 88%. So 88% is a figure that I think is an honest figure in terms of what's happening statewide, but it's going to be fairly slow growth in terms of moving it up towards 100, which, of course, is what we would like.
So, again, just trying to understand the picture. So if a person is only in a shelter for one night or two nights, is a part of what you're saying is that there isn't enough time to develop a safety plan? I'm just trying to understand why you wouldn't do one even in that circumstance where you know you're only going to have a person for a very short period of time. Again, the focus is on safety once the person leaves.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think it's a combination of factors. It depends on the circumstances under which a person might come into the shelter, whether they have children that have immediate needs to be attended to, why that person might be entering shelter. Maybe they leave unexpectedly the next day while they're in the midst of working with the advocate around safety planning. Usually the safety plan is something that's done over a period of time. A person sits down with an advocate. They get to know each other. They talk about the circumstances of the woman's situation. It's something that can't happen in the first half hour that a person arrives at the shelter. So I think given the individuality of each of the circumstances, you see that it's not likely that ever we're going to have 100% safety planning with the individuals who stay at least one night in shelter, but we certainly hope that we'll get closer to that. Also, another factor that's been noted in the studies is that younger women tend to leave without having a safety plan more frequently than the older women. And again, it's data. I'm not entirely sure what that means in terms of the dynamics. But there's some things like that that we're just beginning to look at and try to gear the services so that we can reach those women and have a better success rate with safety planning.
That's very helpful. I'd like to have some more information on the elements of a safety plan.
Okay. Certainly, Madam Chair. I will also mention that the data will be collected through a monthly data report that the shelter agencies are required to complete and send to the Department of Human Services. We share that database jointly with the Department of Human Services presently.
Representative Hansen. Hannah is excused, by the way. And then Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm kind of underwhelmed at a target of 90% when the current status quo is 88. It seems to me that's kind of some hair splitting in terms of the amount of work that we put on performance measures and the importance of them. That the other concern that I have is if this is only affecting the nonprofit service providers, a significant part of the domestic violence support and help are the emergency TANF grants. Mm-hmm. And I would certainly like to see if we're asking the providers for this type of reporting, that DHS itself, when they're making their emergency grants, also would have a safety plan in place. The other one is, I would hope we would continue to work in terms of monitoring. I guess the number of people that 6 months after they've received help from a domestic violence situation, whether they're coming back, whether their safety is actually improved, and how we get to that, I have no idea. But as we're developing a performance measurement in this area, I'd really like to see how it has impacted people's lives. Whereas the safety plan, just having a safety plan, if it hasn't been implemented, or it might not be of a good quality, or people aren't taking advantage of it after they leave, I don't know if that really impacts their lives.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, researchers all over the country are trying to develop a way to accurately measure the improvement in individuals' lives, because you're absolutely on the mark. That's really what everybody wants to see. To date, various studies within Oregon have looked at things such as what service did you come to the shelter to receive and did you receive assistance accessing that service. It still doesn't quite get you there, but that's one of the areas that we hope that the ongoing work group of providers and program coordinators will work on over the next year or two, along with some of the researchers in the state, and see if we can't come closer to that type of a performance. In regards to one of your earlier comments about the 90%, that is a very cautious mark. I think the reason we took a very cautious approach to that in proposing it is simply because of how new the data is and not fully understanding some of the factors that are going on in terms of the safety planning in the shelters. Certainly, we're happy to consider a higher figure if you believe that's warranted, or we'd be happy to come back to you at some point and let you know a little bit more about what the data says.
In the Oregon data that you referred to, and the question, what service did you come here to receive, is that how you framed it? How was that responded to?
Madam Chair, I'd have to get back to you with that information. I don't have the detailed results with me right at this moment.
If you could provide the survey and the responses. Yeah, I'm a little troubled by the 90%. It just seems to me, and again, I need to understand better what the elements are of the so-called safety plan. It just seems to me that even if a person's just been in a shelter for one day, you would want them to leave with some basic information that tells them what to do in case of, and call that part of a safety plan. I feel like I'm missing something here.
Madam Chair, if you would permit it, I would like to come back to this subject tomorrow and share a little bit more information with you. Thank you.
Senator Devlin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's along the same lines. The Chair has already asked my question about some clarification about what a safety plan is. But two questions that I had is that, one, since we're talking about nonprofits, and to be fair, all well-intended, but would it be fair to say that they vary in terms of the resources they have to meet their needs?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, yes.
Second, would this be one of the potential areas, I'm not sure if it is, where if we took a budget reduction in the Department of Justice budget where there may be less resources?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, could you repeat that? Are you concerned about the impact of the 10% reduction?
The 10% reduction, if there would be any impact on any resources available to these shelters. I'm not sure if there would be.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, yes, there would be a reduction in the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund, which in turn supports emergency services at the 50-51 private nonprofit
so
agencies.
Madam Chair, as a follow-up, if you're currently achieving 88 and you have a reduction, I mean, everyone would like you to be at 95 or 100, but if you have a reduction, we should probably recognize in some of our performance measures that where we have a reduction in resources, it may not be possible to have the same level of performance. Not saying that it isn't here, because, I mean, with a lot of hard work by a lot of well-intended people, it may be possible, but some of our areas, I think we have to look at our performance measures in relationship to what we provide in resources.
I think that's very true. In terms of this particular measure, however, the way it's framed, it's targeted to persons leaving the shelter. So assuming they got there, they got some excellent service, it's what they, again, it's what they leave with. That's the piece that we're struggling with.
Madam Chair and Senator Devlin, all of the agencies have multiple funding sources, so that's one factor that it's difficult to build into our performance measure, is not knowing their total funding picture in each individual agency. And then, in addition to that, the cut may affect staffing, which in turn would relate to the ability of those staff to help people in the shelter with safety planning.
Representative Hansen.
A couple of real quick points, and I know you're coming back with this. One thing that would be incredibly helpful as you're talking with the various providers, because of the multiple funding sources, it would be wonderful if we could have some this measurement or a different measurement that applied across the board, so that it was also applying to DHS funded programs, and we could incorporate that as a so we had the same performance measure for multiple programs and multiple agencies, so we could get some comparisons in terms of where are we getting the most bang for the buck.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, this measure was discussed with all of the state program managers that manage dollars for domestic violence. And we are working together in terms of a performance measure that can be used across the board regardless of funding. So this is one that would be applied.
And that's excellent. One possible thing, it would seem to me that to get to the 100%, it would be a lot easier if you were counting the 100% of people that are like a planned exit from a,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That if somebody mm-hmm. interrupts and leaves before they get to the point that you've had an opportunity to develop a safety plan, that's almost impossible to prevent. Or on the other hand, is this what you're actually measuring? The people that leave, you're measuring the people that leave without a safety plan are the people that are exiting the shelters before they've really had a chance to get the full range of services that might be available, which is probably another important thing to measure, or a secondary part of this. Anyway, we'll get back to it. But
Madam Chair and Representative, certainly I think it's reasonable, and everyone would hope that if it's a planned exit, it would be 100%. I don't think there'd be any issue with that whatsoever.
Well, this is a good discussion, and we'll pick it up a little later. Just to do a time check, I'm going to try to move through the rest of the performance measures discussion and then get into it, the Administrative Services Division and hopefully the Division of Child Support. I don't think we're going to make it to the General Counsel Division this afternoon. Please continue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the second area that I'd like to discuss with you today is around sexual assault and a performance measure in that area. There's a great deal that's been going on in regard to sexual assault services in the last couple of years. Sexual assault response teams are being developed throughout the state that provide a more coordinated approach from both the criminal justice standpoint and the services standpoint for sexual assault victims. We see college campuses that are reexamining their policies on sexual assault reporting. We've been doing training of law enforcement and health providers on how to best approach in terms of either criminal justice intervention or medical intervention with sexual assault victims so that we improve the outcome for those types of, for those victims. Also, improvements are being made in terms of the medical response around victims of sexual assault within a hospital or a medical clinic. It's in regards to that change and that we would like to propose the following performance measure. 85% of all sexual assault exams will be conducted by specially trained sexual assault nurse examiners. These are individuals that have received specialized training. They're all registered nurses. And they are able to provide a level of intervention that is commonly not available in emergency rooms that do not have specially trained sexual assault nurse examiners. They can generally provide a response that takes less time in terms of conducting the full exam. They can provide a response that is less costly to the hospital in terms of using physician's time as well as space, such as an emergency room. It's also less costly to victims because you are not using as much of a physician's time. You're using primarily a nurse's time. And in addition to that, you can be assured of the quality of the intervention because sexual assault nurse examiners have all been trained to take a consistent approach to the sexual assault exam and to use particular protocols in conducting the exam. This is something that Oregon's been working on for the last couple of years, and we have quite frankly gone from zero sexual assault nurse examiners who have been certified here in Oregon to over 30 that are presently operating with an Oregon certification as a sexual assault nurse examiner. So while we're proposing the performance measure of 85% of all sexual assault exams being conducted by sexual assault nurse examiners, we would need to use July of 05 through June 06 to establish baseline data because we just don't have it at the moment. We do have a source for this baseline data through the Sexual Assault Victims Emergency Medical Response Fund, as well as the number of crime lab kits, the safe kits or rape kits, as some people call them. Also in 2006, Oregon will become a participant in a national sexual assault nurse examiner database, which will also provide us in future years with more accurate data. For all these reasons, we think that while our goal is for every victim in every county to have access to medical exams provided by specially trained sexual assault nurse examiners, we would like to start out with 85% of all sexual assault exams being conducted by sexual assault nurse examiners.
Of the 30 sexual assault nurse examiners, where are they, geographically speaking?
Madam Chair, I asked that question and I couldn't get an answer. There's still, the surveys are out there and they're still looking into that.
Because your ability to get to the 85% would rest with where they're located.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I should say that we, being not me personally, but many, many people who have worked long and hard in Oregon, have trained 218 individuals as sexual assault nurse examiners. Only 30 have been certified to date because there's a type of an internship that they need to go through before they're fully certified. But that's why we think we'll be able to ramp up fairly quickly in the next year or two. That's all I have on that performance measure.
With Chair Ordley, members of the committee, that concludes our brief overview of performance measures. The last page simply reminds you that you do have an appendix containing additional information, or it's available online on our website.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your work. and we look forward to continuing this conversation with you.
Chair change. Your notebooks for each of the divisions that those are going to does have a phase two tab in it if you have your presentation notebooks with you. I believe if there is material in the phase two tab, please just take that out and recycle it and replace with what we're giving you right now for like administrative services. We're trying to make this as easy as possible as you transition between the phases.
And this is the administrative services. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Gorsuch, members of the committee. My name is Frank Pecha. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Justice. Here to present our Phase 2 segment.
Please continue.
This is a brief overview. We have ahead on the overhead what we have previously mentioned, which is what our responsibility is for the administrative arm for the Attorney General. We provide centralized business services for the Department of Justice. We do that in four areas: fiscal services, operations, which includes facilities and purchasing, that kind of thing, human resources, and information services. Again, kind of as follow-up to the original first presentation, we represent, in terms of the department, expenditure-wise, we're about 5% of the department. By FTE, we represent about 9% of the department. Budget drivers for us are, in to a large extent, dependent on the number of facilities and locations. We have approximately 28 different facilities that we're located in throughout the state. Number of specially funded programs have increased over time. The legislature has seen it appropriate to assign various programs to the Department of Justice, and so we have at this point 22 special funded programs. With those come additional reporting requirements, sometimes a special bank account, sometimes a special change we have to make in the budgetary structure in order to segment and separate the particular funding in the program area. As Connie Gallagher was just up here talking about performance measures for crime victims is one of the areas that has had growth in terms of the number of checks we actually issue to victims of crime. We issue those checks through administrative services and process most of the paperwork there. Vendor payments also have increased, and to a large extent that's due to the increase in various program areas that are assigned to the Department of Justice. Another big area that is becoming more and more prevalent and important is everything you see in the paper about IS security. Security becomes much more important for us. We have a lot of confidential information. Some of it's similar to what you would have at DHS, but some of it different than that. Some of our programs tie into federal databases who have strict restrictions on use of that data and information and requirements about our ability to make sure that information is safe and won't get into the wrong hands.
Should be back there.
Looking at our division from a pie chart representing the types of expenses, personal services for us is about 75%, which is a little bit lower than the average in the rest of the department. That's because we provide a lot of S&S type of activity services and supplies, which is 23%. We do have very little capital outlay and no special payments. And our budget runs about $13,389,000. The next slide is the budget history slide for you. This chose, and it was referred to earlier both by LFO staff, Mr. Wilson, and by Attorney General Myers. There were some changes. You can see some FTE changes in between 03 and 05 down at the very bottom of the page, from 85 to 109. This represents a zero-sum game really to the department in terms of positions, but merely a shifting of some IS positions from the department, from the Child Support Division to Administrative Services as we centralized our IS function. Our budget history, looking at this graphically, we're covering both our FTE here and our total budget in dollars. You can see that same shift between 0305 and 0507 in terms of personnel, and that's merely the shifting between budget structures of the IS staff that was originally in the Division of Child Support, now is in administration with the kind of core group of IS staff that we have originally. Key program changes for administration. As I mentioned earlier, we have many specially funded programs, quite a few of them added since 1997. During the 0305 budget session, we have the integration of DCS into Division of Child Support into the Department of Justice. This is, as Attorney General Myers mentioned, the integration of the full program and some administrative staff that came over to the Department of Justice. That has brought with it some additional accounting requirements. We have a person dedicated to doing accounting for the child support program, also in reporting. And as I mentioned earlier, child support program is spread out throughout the state in order to be accessible by its client base, as opposed to where the Department of Justice legal services is basically centered down the valley, where the primary requests for service are from the various agencies. So overall, we have 28 various facilities or buildings throughout the state. And consolidation of IS services is another key program change, as I mentioned. This is bringing over what we call the local area network staff and the people that work on our websites, where we had two different groups. We had a group in administration, and when I say group, they're very small, one or two people. Then we had one or two over in child support. We brought those together as well. In our phase two presentation, we're going to talk a little bit about at an agency level the various types of personal service contracts. The idea was that I would just kind of give you a brief overview of what some of those are for the agency overall. We have a variety of legal services of personal service contracts. The legal staff for the state, there are times when we still need to go out and get special assistant attorney generals. We call them SAGs, kind of as a short acronym. They have specialized work that they'll do where we may not have that expertise in-house. It may not be actually, in some cases, cost-effective for us to actually build a particular legal expertise. One of the examples is just the next one down in legal services under special assistant attorney generals is bond counsel. This is a very specialized field. So at times we have to actually go out and get additional attorney assistance in various areas. Also, when we're working in court cases, a couple of the items mentioned here for personal service contracts are like medical experts, forensics experts, court reporters, all related. The significant amount of that is related to putting together a trial case, trial to represent the state in a particular matter. On the child support side, we have personal service contracts, and the two areas that are the predominant areas where we will have personal service contracts and child support, our central hearings panel, our also oral and written translation services are very important. So those are key areas where we have personal service contracts in the department. This particular slide gives you the dollar value of those that are paid by the department. If you see that, we currently run about $7 million in contracts that we actually pay out through the Department of Justice. Long-term vacancy positions, agency-wide, as of December 31st, 2004, we had 15 positions vacant. That's approximately 1% out of our 1,200 roughly staff or FTE for the department. We've delineated where those positions were, what the vacancies were. To give you an idea of the reasoning behind those, we have some that are related to an original policy package, ODOT Transportation Initiative. That work is now starting to come in. And we also had some positions filled, and we also were using some as we restructured the organization a bit in certain areas where we had to do some self-financing policy packages for 05-07. In the governor's recommended budget, that was to create our CIO position. We used internal resource within admin services, a position in admin services, and a position in the Division of Child Support to create that. Okay. Major budgetary issues. The governor's budget approves two other fund policy packages, and those packages are simply in two areas. One is the renovation of the Justice Building, which is the DAS initiative, which we are the primary tenant along with the Judicial Department. And we have some costs that are one-time costs, which we're going to basically just suck up and try and manage through tight cost control. But we do have ongoing costs, such as rent. And so rent is the item that we want to have ongoing funding for, because it's not a one-time cost, and we will continue to have rent in the Justice Building. Consolidation of IS under the new CIO is the other policy package. It results in a net zero in position increases for the department, because really what this package is talking about is just the funding and establish of the CIO position with the elimination of two other positions within the department. The next slide actually will give you 104. Mine went in the same order. Okay. Agency program and support, package 104. This is the package that establishes the CIO position, Chief Information Officer. This is a position that's responsible for overseeing the IS consolidation. When we bring these folks together, we'll have both mainframe and LAN staff. At this point, we're just consolidating the LAN staff and the web service staff. This position, as you can see on the overhead, is our high-level guide for directing plans and the Department of Justice future technology. As I indicated, we've eliminated two positions to create this one. Net cost to the state is zero. Policy package 10060. This is a policy package that deals with the consolidation of information services. We're moving 23 positions from the Division of Child Support, about 22 and a half FTE, to Admin Services. That consolidation then reflects the numbers. You'll see a decrease in the Division of Child Support. You'll see that increase in Admin Services. Our result is just it's a zero-sum game, just moving between budget structures so that we can keep the people organized budgetarily in the right cubbyholes. Policy Package 103, the Justice Building Renovation. This is one of DAS's capital improvement projects. There will be a full mechanical, structural, electrical, seismic, and accessibility upgrade. We're going to meet DAS standards. The DAS space planner is organized at all for us to make the most use of the space available. Down below you can see that I've provided you some information in terms of what some of the costs are associated with that. The subtotal amount of $710,690 is the amount that we're asking just for the limitation for. We're not asking and have not built that into the legal services rate. That's something we're going to try and manage ourselves through cost control and cost containment. The amount that we are asking for is the rent, which is the ongoing cost that's going to be hitting us year after year after year.
Mr. Petrie,
yes.
Could you describe what is meant by systems furniture?
Systems furniture is what you will see as office in an open landscape environment in any one of the state buildings. Currently the newer ones that you would go through, and even the older ones. System furniture is the modular furniture that connects, that has a side panels, integrated type desks that fit into them. It allows a space planner basically to maximize the use of the room to get as many people in there as the fire code will allow and as we can physically do. They have a set of standards that they go by, and we've worked with them over the last year and a half in developing the layout and working with how to maximize the use of the space so that we can get the most bang for our buck, so to speak, in getting the most people in there. Because otherwise, if we don't, then that just creates additional cost in terms of wanting additional space in addition.
That's helpful, the information you've given.
Okay.
Answers the question. Thank you.
That is the end of our presentation.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Out of your total budget, it would appear that a lot of it are you're doing administrative services for programs that are also partially funded through federal grants. Do you account for that separately? Do we get federal funds to offset that, or how is that accounted for?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, in terms of the federal programs that we have, if we charge special programs for their particular service that we provide to them. Now, currently what we're doing this on is we, in terms of staff time, we actually have a system where folks enter their time, we can actually charge them accurately about for the amount of time spent. When it comes to something like an S&S item, services and supplies such as rent, or if it's a purchase like systems furniture where they're getting new furniture, we will allocate to that particular program area its share of the cost, so that if the program is supported by either outside fees or by federal funds, those federal funds or outside fees bear their share of the cost of whatever improvement is made to that particular program. So we will allocate out those costs to the programs as well as to legal services, and we do it based on benefit that's derived from whatever we're doing.
Okay.
Madam Chair, they must have an approved federal cost allocation plan that is
part of that process for federal funds that the feds must approve regularly.
Every 2 years? Or annually, I can't remember right now.
Well, they approve our plan every year.
Well, this looks like a good place to end the presentations for this afternoon. And members, tomorrow we'll pick up with the Division of Child Support and the General Counsel Division. And thank you very much to all the agency folks for your hard work and preparation. And if there's no additional business, we are adjourned.